A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to complete the picture on Iran's nuclear program and the enrichment physics we've touched on in the past. Four questions, really. Why is 60% considered highly enriched? What's special about 90% that makes it weapons grade? What does the enrichment percentage actually mean as a metric? And is there a theoretical maximum? And finally, does that maximum have any practical implications for what a regime like Iran could do? Or is 100% enrichment purely academic?
These are exactly the right questions. Most coverage throws around 60% and 90%, like they're self-explanatory, and they're really not. The physics here is genuinely elegant, and the strategic implications flow directly from it.
Walk me through the metric first. When we say uranium is enriched to 3.67%, or 20%, or 60%, what are we actually measuring?
We're measuring the fraction of uranium-235 isotopes in the material. Natural uranium that comes out of the ground is about 0.7% U-235. The other 99.3% is U-238, which is basically useless for fission chain reactions in the way we need them. So enrichment is the process of increasing the concentration of that fissile isotope. You're sorting atoms by a mass difference of less than 1%. And the scale of this is hard to overstate. A single centrifuge rotor might spin at 50 to 70,000 RPM for years to produce meaningful quantities. The IAEA inspectors measure enrichment levels using mass spectrometry and gamma spectroscopy when they take environmental swipe samples at facilities like Natanz and Fordow. They're looking for exactly this ratio.
When we say Iran has enriched to 60%, we mean that out of every 1,000 uranium atoms in that sample, 600 are the fissile U-235 isotope.
And that's what makes the percentage metric so intuitive once you understand it. It's literally just the proportion. But the intuition breaks down when you think about the work required, because the relationship is deeply non-linear.
This is the part I've always found fascinating. The enrichment curve.
Going from natural uranium at 0.7% up to reactor grade at 3 to 5%. That's where you spend most of your separative work units, or SWUs. Getting to 20% is another substantial push. But then something weird happens. The jump from 20% to 60%? That takes roughly as much work as going from natural to 5%. And the jump from 60 to 90%? That's only about a quarter to a third of the work you've already done to reach 60.
The hard part's already done.
Once you have a stockpile at 60%, you're not at the starting line. You're at the 80-yard line. The IAEA and intelligence communities call this being weaponized capable rather than weaponized, but the distinction is getting awfully thin. The technical term is breakout time. How long it would take to produce enough 90% material for one bomb from your current stockpile. At 60%, most estimates put breakout at somewhere between a few weeks and a couple of months, depending on how many centrifuges are running.
That's why 60% is the threshold where the world gets uncomfortable. It's not that 60% itself is a bomb material. It's not. You can't make a weapon from 60%. But you've done something like 70 to 80% of the total work needed to get to 90.
Iran knows this. The IAEA reported in May that Iran's stockpile of 60% enriched uranium had reached about 275 kilograms. If you enrich that further, you're looking at enough material for multiple weapons. The physics doesn't care about diplomatic statements.
Which brings us to the second question. What is so special about 90%? Why is that the magic number we call weapons grade?
This is where the physics gets really interesting, and it's not just an arbitrary threshold. 90% U-235 is what's required for what nuclear weapons designers call a prompt critical assembly with a reasonably small amount of material.
That's the term I want to unpack.
In a nuclear reactor, the chain reaction is controlled. Neutrons split uranium atoms, releasing more neutrons, which split more atoms, but the whole thing is designed so that each fission produces, on average, exactly one additional fission. That's criticality, a steady state. If you're slightly above that, you get a slow power increase. Operators can manage it.
Prompt critical is not that.
Prompt critical is when the chain reaction multiplies so fast that it outruns any mechanical feedback. We're talking about neutron populations doubling in billionths of a second. The energy release goes from 0 to kilotons before the material has time to thermally expand and disassemble itself. That's a nuclear explosion.
The enrichment level determines whether you can achieve that.
It determines how small your device can be and still work. You could theoretically make a bomb with uranium enriched to 20%, but the critical mass would be impractically large. We're talking tons, not kilograms. The weapon would be undeliverable. At 90%, the bare sphere critical mass for U-235 is about 52 kilograms. With a neutron reflector, which is standard in weapon design, you can bring that down to perhaps 15 to 20 kilograms.
Weapons grade is ultimately a packaging problem. How much boom can you fit in? How small a package? And can you deliver it?
And it's why the international community settled on 90% as the de facto threshold. Below that, you're fighting physics for every percentage point of yield efficiency. Above 90, you're in the realm of straightforward gun-type weapon designs, the simplest kind, where you just fire one subcritical piece into another. The Hiroshima bomb, Little Boy, used about 64 kilograms of 80% enriched uranium. It was inefficient by modern standards. Today's designers want 90% or higher because it lets them build smaller, lighter, more reliable devices.
The little boy was 80%, not 90.
80%, yes. And it still worked. But it was enormous. It weighed over 4 tons, and it used an absurd amount of uranium for the yield it produced. Modern weapons are dramatically smaller. A 90% enrichment level means you can put a warhead on a ballistic missile instead of needing a B-29 bomber.
That's the practical reality. Iran at 60% doesn't have a bomb. But it has a stockpile that could be further enriched to 90% in a sprint. And the sprint is short.
The sprint is short, and it gets shorter every time they install another cascade of advanced centrifuges. The IR-6 and IR-9 centrifuges, Iran has deployed at Natanz, are vastly more efficient than the IR-1s they started with. An IR-9 can produce something like 50 times the separative work of an IR-1. So when you hear that Iran is installing new cascades, that's not just incremental, that's them compressing the breakout timeline.
Which is why the 60% threshold is treated as a red line by Israel and the US. Not because 60 is a weapon, but because it represents a decision point where breakout becomes measured in days rather than months or years.
There's a detail here that most coverage misses. The IAEA doesn't just look at enrichment level, they look at the form of the material. Uranium hexafluoride gas, UF6, is what you feed into centrifuges. Once you've enriched it to your target level, you have to convert it into a solid form for weapon use, typically uranium metal or uranium oxide. That conversion step takes time and leaves signatures.
Inspectors are watching for conversion facilities, not just enrichment facilities.
And Iran has been doing things that make inspectors nervous on this front too. They produced small amounts of uranium metal in the past, which they claimed was for reactor fuel development. But 60% enriched uranium metal doesn't have a civilian application that makes much sense. Research reactors that use high-enriched uranium typically run on 20% or 93%. There's no reactor design that specifically needs 60% metal.
The combination of enrichment level and material form starts to tell a story.
It tells a story that's hard to explain away, and that's before we get to the question of 100% enrichment.
Daniel's fourth question. Is 100% enrichment a purely theoretical level, and does it have any practical implications?
Here's the thing. 100% enrichment doesn't really exist in practice, and it probably never will. There's always some residual U-238, even in the most aggressively enriched material. The U.S. weapons program aimed for about 93 to 95%, and that was considered more than sufficient. The Soviets aimed for similar levels.
Why not push higher? If you've done the hard work to get to 90, why not go to 99?
Every additional percentage point above 90 requires more separative work, but gives you essentially no meaningful improvement in weapon performance. the critical mass curve flattens out. Going from 90 to 95% might reduce your critical mass by a few percent, but the additional time and energy required to achieve that purity isn't worth it. You're better off building more weapons with 90% material than slightly better weapons with 95% material.
The practical ceiling is determined by engineering economics, not physics.
Physically, you could keep enriching until you're at 99.9%, and some research applications use very highly enriched uranium at 93 to 97% for specific neutron physics experiments. But for weapons, the sweet spot has always been right around 90. The Manhattan Project didn't even aim for 100%. They knew it was wasteful.
Which means when we talk about Iran's enrichment program, the question isn't really will they reach 100%. The question is whether they'll cross 90, and how fast.
Whether the international community will know in time. That's the intelligence problem. If Iran decides to break out, to kick out inspectors, feed their 60% stockpile into Cascades, and sprint to 90, the timeline is alarmingly short. Some estimates put it at under 2 weeks with their current centrifuge capacity.
Under 2 weeks?
Under 2 weeks. And that's assuming they want to produce enough for one device. If they're willing to settle for a crude device with a larger critical mass, say, using 80% material like Little Boy, it could be even faster. The physics is unforgiving in that direction.
Let's back up to something you mentioned earlier, because I think it's worth pulling on. The non-linearity of the enrichment curve. Why is it that going from 0.7 to 5% takes so much more work than going from 60 to 90? Intuitively, you'd think the opposite, that getting the last few impurities out would be the hardest part.
This is one of my favorite things to explain because it's so counterintuitive. The key is that enrichment is a statistical process. In a centrifuge, you're not picking individual atoms. You're creating a concentration gradient, and the separation factor per stage is small. You need many stages in series. A cascade. A cascade.
You're doing a little bit of separation, over and over.
Over and over. And the amount of separative work required depends on the concentration at both ends of the cascade, the product stream and the tails or depleted stream. When you're starting with natural uranium at 0.7%, you have to process an enormous amount of material to get even a small amount of enriched product, because most of the U-235 stays behind in the tails.
Once you've already got material at 60%, you're feeding the cascade with something that's already mostly what you want.
The concentration difference between your feed and your product is much smaller relative to the absolute values. The formula for separative work involves a term called the value function, which is V of x equals 1 minus 2x times the natural log of 1 minus x over x, where x is the enrichment fraction.
I'm staying with you.
When you plug in the numbers, the value function at 0.7% is about 4.5. At 60%, it's about 0.6. At 90%, it's about 0.2. The separative work is the difference between the value of the product and the value of the feed, times the amount of material. So when you're enriching from natural uranium, you're climbing a huge value function hill. When you're going from 60 to 90, you're strolling up a gentle slope.
The hill is already behind you.
The hill is behind you, and this is why the IAEA's reporting on enrichment levels matters so much. When they say Iran has produced 275 kilograms of 60% material, the key number isn't the 60, it's the fact that 275 kilograms represents an enormous amount of separative work already completed. That work is banked. It can't be taken back.
That's a useful way to think about it.
It's the most useful way. Sanctions and diplomacy can slow the rate at which new separative work is done, but they can't undo the work that's already been banked in the form of enriched material. That stockpile is a sunk cost from a non-proliferation standpoint.
Which is why the debate about a strike on Iranian nuclear facilities is so fraught. You can destroy centrifuges, but can you destroy the knowledge and the stockpile?
The stockpile is distributed. Iran has enrichment sites at Natanz, at Fordow, which is buried under a mountain, and they have stockpiles at multiple locations. The IAEA has had disputes with Iran about undeclared nuclear material found at sites like Turksabad. The inspection regime is robust, but it's not omniscient.
Let's talk about the IAEA for a moment, because they're central to this whole picture. How do they actually measure enrichment levels in practice?
IAEA inspectors take swipe samples, literally wiping surfaces inside enrichment facilities with small cloth squares, and then those samples are analyzed at the IAEA's Cybersdorf laboratory in Austria and at partner labs in the network. They use mass spectrometry to measure the isotopic ratios. They can detect particles of highly enriched uranium at the level of individual microns. The sensitivity is extraordinary, and they can distinguish between different enrichment levels and even trace the material back to specific facilities based on the chemical signatures and particle morphology. It's forensic nuclear science at an almost absurd level of precision.
If Iran were to enrich a small batch to 90% as a test, the IAEA would almost certainly find the evidence.
But almost is doing a lot of work there. Iran has restricted inspector access to certain sites in the past. In 2021, they stopped allowing inspectors to access the centrifuge component manufacturing workshops. In 2023, they disconnected IAEA surveillance cameras at several enrichment facilities. The cameras were later reconnected, but there's a gap in the monitoring record that can't be reconstructed.
A gap in the record? That's the kind of thing that keeps intelligence analysts up at night.
It really is. And it's not just about enrichment levels. It's about the entire fuel cycle. Iran has a heavy water reactor at Arak that was originally designed to produce plutonium, an alternative path to a weapon. They agreed to redesign it under the 2015 nuclear deal, but construction has continued in various forms. The plutonium path is less discussed than the uranium path, but it's still there.
That's the deal the Trump administration pulled out of in 2018, and then the Biden administration tried to revive, and now here we are.
The deal's constraints were specifically designed around this enrichment physics. The JCPOA limited Iran to 3.67% enrichment, capped the stockpile at 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium, and restricted the number and type of centrifuges. The goal was to keep breakout time at a minimum of 1 year. With the deal essentially dead and Iran enriching to 60%, that 1 year breakout time is a distant memory.
3.67% to 60% is a policy failure measured in SWUs.
It's a policy failure measured in SWUs and in years. The enrichment curve was well understood in the 1940s. The intelligence community and the IAEA knew exactly what the implications would be if Iran was allowed to progress beyond the JCPOA limits. This wasn't a surprise.
What's the current state of play? You mentioned 275 kilograms at 60%. What does that actually mean in weapons terms?
The rough rule of thumb is that about 25 kilograms of 90% U-235 is enough for a simple implosion device, and about 50 kilograms for a gun-type device. If Iran has 275 kilograms at 60% and they further enrich it to 90%, you lose some material in the process. The tail still contains some U-235, but you'd end up with perhaps 60 to 80 kilograms of weapons-grade material. That's enough for 3 to 5 weapons, depending on design sophistication.
3 to 5 weapons from the current stockpile alone.
From the current 60% stockpile alone, and they're producing more every month. The IAEA's May 2026 report noted that Iran's production rate of 60% material had increased significantly since the start of the year. We're not talking about a static threat.
This is before we even discuss the possibility of a North Korea-style test.
A nuclear test is a political decision, not a technical one. The physics of a gun-type device using 90% uranium is so well understood that a test isn't strictly necessary to have confidence the weapon will work. Little Boy was never tested before Hiroshima. They were that confident in the design. An implosion device is trickier and would probably require testing, but a gun-type weapon is essentially a sure thing.
That's a chilling detail. The simplest design doesn't need a test.
It doesn't. And that's why the enrichment level matters so much. If you have 90% material, you can build a functional nuclear weapon with 1940s technology. No computers, no advanced manufacturing, no precision electronics. Just precision machining and conventional explosives. The hard part is the enrichment. Everything else is comparatively straightforward.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about 100% enrichment. If 90% is already sufficient for a gun-type device, and 93% is sufficient for compact modern warheads, the pursuit of higher enrichment levels would be purely for What?
There's essentially no weapon-related reason to go above 95%. The only applications for ultra-high enrichment, like 99% plus, are in research reactors, isotope production for medical applications, and some specialized neutron sources. And even those applications are increasingly moving toward low-enriched uranium alternatives for non-proliferation reasons.
If Iran were to announce they're pursuing 99% enrichment, it would be hard to interpret as anything other than a deliberate provocation, or a cover for something else.
It would be a signal, yes. But it's not one they're likely to send, because it would be transparently unnecessary for any plausible civilian program and would unify international opposition in a way that 60% hasn't quite done. 60% sits in a gray zone. It's above any civilian reactor requirement, but it's below the technical definition of weapons grade. It's a threshold designed to test boundaries.
The gray zone. That's where Iran has been operating for years now.
They've been operating there skillfully from a strategic standpoint. Every incremental step, 5%, 20%, 60%, has been met with condemnation but not with decisive action. Each new threshold becomes the new normal, and the international community's red lines keep shifting.
The shifting red line is its own kind of enrichment curve. Each step makes the next one easier.
That's a very apt way to put it, and it's why understanding the physics matters. When an IAEA report says Iran has produced uranium enriched to 60%, the number sounds abstract. But when you understand that 60% means they've done roughly 3/4 of the work toward a weapon, and that the remaining quarter could be done in weeks, the abstraction disappears.
Let me ask you something. You mentioned the value function earlier. Is there a point on that curve where the international community should have drawn the line and didn't?
The 20% threshold was probably the most consequential missed opportunity. 20% is a genuine civilian threshold. Research reactors use 20% fuel, and the Tehran Research Reactor has a legitimate need for it. But 20% is also the point where the enrichment curve starts to bend. Going from 20 to 90% requires only about 1/5 the separative work of going from natural uranium to 20%. Once Iran had a stockpile of 20% material, breakout became a matter of months rather than years. The JCPOA recognized this by requiring Iran to dilute or convert its 20% stockpile. When that constraint collapsed, the path to 60% was open.
From 60 to 90 is even easier.
The separative work from 60 to 90 is about 1/4 of the work from natural to 60. It's the home stretch.
The entire enrichment enterprise is a series of diminishing barriers. Each step is easier than the last.
And that's what makes it such a difficult policy problem. The first step, from natural to reactor grade, requires massive industrial infrastructure and years of operation. But once that infrastructure exists, and the material is already partially enriched, each subsequent step is faster and harder to detect or prevent.
The infrastructure itself is the red line.
The infrastructure is the red line. And Iran has the infrastructure. Thousands of centrifuges, multiple facilities, a trained workforce, and a stockpile of partially enriched material. These aren't things that can be negotiated away.
Which is why the current situation feels so intractable. Sanctions can slow the program, but not reverse it. Diplomacy can set limits, but not eliminate capability. And military strikes can destroy facilities, but not knowledge.
The knowledge is the ultimate challenge. Iran has been operating centrifuges for decades. They understand the metallurgy, the rotor dynamics, the cascade design. You can't bomb that understanding. And the stockpile is the other irreducible challenge. Even if you destroyed every centrifuge in Iran tomorrow, the 60% material would still exist.
What happens to that material over time? Does enriched uranium degrade?
U-235 has a half-life of 700 million years. It's not going anywhere. The material will remain weapons, usable, essentially, forever. The only way to eliminate the proliferation risk is to remove or dilute the material. Blend it down with natural or depleted uranium to bring the enrichment level back below 5%. That's what the JCPOA required for Iran's 20% stockpile. It's physically possible, but it requires political agreement.
Political agreement is in short supply.
The current environment, and here I'm referring to the Trump administration's approach, has been focused on maximum pressure rather than negotiated constraints. The theory is that economic pressure will force Iran to the table. The counterargument is that while pressure mounts, centrifuges keep spinning.
There's an asymmetry there. Economic pressure hurts over months and years. Enrichment advances happen every day.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Centrifuges don't take weekends off. The IR-9 cascades at Natanz are running continuously. Every hour, the stockpile grows. Every hour, the breakout time shrinks.
That's a sobering thought to sit with. Let's pull back to the physics for a moment, because I want to make sure we fully answer Daniel's questions. Enrichment percentage. We've established it's the fraction of U-235 in the material. 60% is highly enriched, because it represents most of the separative work already done toward weapons usability. 90% is weapons grade, because it enables combat to reliable nuclear devices with practical critical masses. 100% is theoretically achievable, but practically pointless for weapons.
That's the summary. And I'd add one nuance on the 60% threshold. The IAEA defines high-enriched uranium as anything above 20%. So in the formal taxonomy, 60% isn't just highly enriched in a colloquial sense, it's legally in the category that triggers the most stringent safeguards. The distinction between 20 and 60 is a distinction of degree within that category, not a difference in kind.
Even 20% is legally high enriched.
The IAEA's definition is clear. Above 20%, you're in HEU territory. The practical difference between 20 and 60 is about breakout speed, not about whether the material is proliferation sensitive.
That's why the JCPOA's 3.67% cap mattered. It kept Iran out of HEU territory entirely.
3.67% is well within the LEU range, low enriched uranium. It's what commercial power reactors use. You cannot build a weapon from 3.67% material in any practical sense. The critical mass would be enormous. The JCPOA's cap was designed to make breakout a multi-year endeavor.
The physics dictated the policy.
And the abandonment of the policy allowed the physics to reassert itself.
Let me ask one more question about the measurement side. You mentioned gamma spectroscopy and mass spectrometry. When the IAEA takes a swipe sample, how precise are these measurements? Can they distinguish between, say, 60% and 61%?
The precision is on the order of fractions of a percent. Mass spectrometry can measure isotopic ratios to within 0.01% or better. So when the IAEA reports that Iran has enriched to 60%, that's not a rounded number, it's a measurement. And the pattern of enrichment levels across different particles can tell inspectors whether the material came from a single batch or multiple production runs.
It's a forensic timeline in particulate form.
And Iran knows this, which is why their restrictions on inspector access and the removal of surveillance cameras are so significant. They're not just hiding activities, they're trying to degrade the IAEA's ability to reconstruct the history of the program.
The surveillance gap you mentioned, how long was that gap?
The cameras at the centrifuge component workshops were disconnected for several months in 2023. When they were reconnected, the IAEA was unable to verify that no components had been diverted during that period. It's not evidence of diversion, but it's an absence of evidence. And in the nuclear verification world, that absence is itself a concern.
Absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, but it's certainly not reassuring.
It's the opposite of reassuring, and the IAEA has been unusually direct about this in their quarterly reports. They've used language like, the agency's knowledge of Iran's nuclear program is no longer continuous, which, in the calibrated language of IAEA reports, is about as close to alarm as they get.
The IAEA doesn't do alarm.
The IAEA doesn't do alarm. They do understatement. So when they say knowledge is no longer continuous, the translation is, we don't know what happened during that gap, and we may never know.
That's a heavy note. Let me pivot slightly, because I think there's an interesting question embedded in Daniel's prompt that we haven't fully addressed. The prompt asks about the maximal enrichment level and whether it has implications for what a regime could do. We've talked about weapons. Are there other applications at the very high end of enrichment that would matter strategically?
There's one that's worth mentioning, naval reactor fuel. Some naval reactors, particularly those on submarines and aircraft carriers, use highly enriched uranium at 93% or higher. The French use LEU in their naval reactors, but the US and UK have historically used HEU. If Iran were to claim they're enriching to 90% for a naval reactor program, that would be a claim worth scrutinizing closely.
Because Iran doesn't have nuclear submarines.
Iran doesn't have nuclear submarines, and building one would be a multi-decade project. It's not a credible near-term justification. But it's the kind of claim that could be used to muddy the waters, to create ambiguity about intent.
The civilian cover story problem.
The civilian cover story problem. And it's particularly acute at enrichment levels above 20%. There are legitimate civilian uses for 20% material, research reactors, medical isotope production. Above 20%, the civilian applications narrow dramatically. Above 60%, they essentially vanish. There is no power reactor, no research reactor, no medical isotope facility that requires 60% enriched uranium.
60% is, by any reasonable standard, a military program.
It's a military program or it's a bargaining chip. Those are the two interpretations that make sense. Either Iran intends to use the material for weapons, or they're accumulating it as leverage in negotiations. The problem is that from a physics standpoint, the distinction doesn't matter. The material exists either way, and it can be further enriched either way.
Intent is almost irrelevant when capability is established.
In nuclear non-proliferation, capability often is intent. That's the whole logic of the IAEA safeguard system. You don't wait for a state to declare they're building a weapon. You look at the capabilities they're developing, and you assess whether those capabilities have a plausible civilian justification. At 60%, the justification collapses.
That's been true since Iran first announced 60% enrichment in 2021, following the Natanz sabotage incident. They framed it as a response to Israeli actions, but the physics doesn't care about the justification. Once the material exists, the breakout clock is ticking.
The rhetorical fog is thick in this space. You hear terms like breakout capacity and significant quantity and weaponized capable, all of which are terms of art with specific technical meanings. But the underlying physics is remarkably simple. Sort atoms by mass. Increase the fraction of the fissile isotope. Reach a concentration where a chain reaction can sustain itself explosively. Everything else is commentary.
We're back to where we started.
We're back to where we started. The entire Iranian nuclear crisis, decades of diplomacy and sanctions, and covert operations and threats of war, it all comes down to the statistical mechanics of separating U-235 from U-238 in a spinning cylinder.
When you put it that way, it sounds almost absurd.
It is absurd, and it's also the defining strategic challenge of the Middle East for the past two decades. The fate of millions of people rests on the physics of isotope separation.
That's a good place to leave the technical discussion. I think we've covered all four of Daniel's questions. The metric, the 60% significance, the 90% weapons-grade threshold, and the practical irrelevance of 100%. Anything we missed?
I'd just add one closing thought on the maximal enrichment question. There is a theoretical maximum. You can't exceed 100% by definition. But the practical maximum is determined by the separation technology. Modern gas centrifuges can achieve about 99% purity if configured for it. But again, nobody does this for weapons because it's wasteful. The Manhattan Project set the pattern. 93% was the goal for their implosion designs, and that's remained the benchmark. If Iran ever reaches 90%, the technical difference between 90 and 93 or 95 is negligible from a strategic standpoint. The threshold that matters is 60 to 90. After 90, it's all academic.
Academic, but not irrelevant. Because if Iran ever announced enrichment to 99%, it would be a statement. Not a technical statement, a political one.
It would be a declaration of capability, the nuclear equivalent of a flyby.
We'd be having a very different conversation.
We'd be having a very different conversation.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the late 1600s, a mastodon tooth found in New York's Hudson Valley was analyzed and described as having the substance of true bone, but black as jet and as heavy as iron. The result of groundwater rich in iron and manganese replacing the original calcium phosphate structure atom by atom over thousands of years.
Thank you, Hilbert.
That's somehow both unsettling and completely on brand for this show.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, and thanks to everyone listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more people find the show.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.